Welcome to Little Atoms on Resonance 104.4 FM, a live talk show about ideas and culture, with an emphasis on ideas of the Enlightenment.
Little Atoms is presented by Neil Denny, Padraig Reedy, Richard Sanderson and Becky Hogg, as well as regular guest presenters.
Little Atoms actively promotes science, freedom of expression, scepticism and secular humanism.
Our guests bring ideas that are challenging, sometimes controversial, often polemical, but always interesting.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of Little Atoms. Tonight just with me, Neil Denny, and I'm joined by science writer Brian Clegg. Brian Clegg is a science journalist and writer. He runs www.popularscience.co.uk and is the author of In-Flight Science, A Guide to the World from Your Aeroplane Window, which we'll be talking about this evening. Brian's other books include Armageddon Science, Before the Big Bang, and A Brief History of Infinity. Brian, welcome to Little Atoms.
Good evening.
I suppose we should first of all talk about where the idea to write a book about the science of flight came from.
Yeah, I guess it's partly out of my background because I did used to work at British Airways for a good few years. I used to play around with fun technology in BA and things of that kind before I started writing books. So it was partly that. But also, if you think about it, it's one of the best chances you've got to really experience quite a lot of science going on around you. You know, you don't stay up there by magic. And also, I think it's one of those things where we've lost a sort of sense of wonder. It's almost become rather boring flying, but when you think about it, it's pretty amazing stuff that you're doing. Kids still realise that, but we don't anymore.
But the process of flying itself, you know, the experience that we will all go through is incredibly boring. The 2 hours in the terminal building beforehand, you know, the sitting there strapped into your seats flight. I mean, the whole thing, there's a quote in the book where you talk about the dual problems of flight as being fear and boredom. So is in some ways the book an attempt to combat both of those things?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I have to confess, I'm not a good flyer. I hate flying in terms of actually being in a plane, and having something to distract you can be pretty good. But also, as you say, it is a boring process. There's a lot of sitting around. So it just seemed a nice opportunity because you're in an environment where there's lots of science around you, not just the plane, but everything you can see around you out of the window when you're flying and all that kind of thing. There was a great chance to explore that.
So you work for BA for, I think it was 17 years?
Yeah, that's right.
Was it?
Yeah.
And you just said you remain quite a nervous flyer. So
yeah.
Was that, you know, how could you travel that often and still remain a nervous flyer? Do you not just get used to it?
Well, funnily, it was the other way around. I used to fly a huge amount and I used to do absolutely stupid things in terms of flying because it was so cheap. So I once flew to both ends of the country the same day just to deliver Valentine cards kind of thing. But over time, I mean, it was partly experiencing one or two near misses, but also just I think I'd had enough of it, basically, and it started to get on my nerves a bit, the whole flying experience, and I've never really been that enthusiastic since. So I love the concept, but the actual doing it, it's nice to have something to distract you.
Let's the book is basically structured through the experience if you're taking a flight. So you start off in the airport terminal. So let's perhaps have a look at some of the things that you talk about. We're in the airport. We've just turned up at the airport. What would we expect to experience?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, the stuff going on all around you that is technology-based, I haven't really bothered with it, the sort of basic stuff like check-in and that kind of thing. You can't cover everything, but there are some interesting things. I mean, I guess in the news a bit in the last year or two have been the full-body scanners that are relatively new. So that's sort of quite an interesting bit of technology there.
People think these things basically see you. You're naked on the other side of the scanner, but that's not actually what happens.
Well, that's right. I mean, the image is like a very crude computer game image, effectively. You know, you couldn't recognise an individual from it, and in that sense, I wouldn't be that worried about it. And the other thing that people aren't sure about is, you know, you're being bombarded with some sort of rays that are going to be dangerous. And the most common sort does use X-rays, but they use very low-intensity X-rays. They actually sort of bounce them off you rather than sending them through you. And I think a good comparison really is that the sort of exposure to radiation you get from that is the equivalent of just over a minute's flight. Because when you're flying, you actually do get exposed to a little bit of radiation because you're higher up, and the cosmic radiation that's coming, hitting the Earth, you get more of when you're up there. And just over a minute's worth of flight is about the same amount of exposure as you have been going through one of those scanners.
Well, we should talk straight on about the next part then. So how much exposure to radiation are we getting on, say, a typical transatlantic flight?
Well, radiation is one of the things. I mean, we had it a lot, obviously, with the Japanese nuclear power plant. It worries people. I'd say, to be honest, out of proportion to the actual danger. Understandably enough, you know, when you think of the context of nuclear bombs and all that kind of stuff, if we talk about radiation in that sense. But radiation is a totally natural thing. In fact, if I took you and stuck you in a lead-lined box, you would still be exposed to radiation because your body actually gives off radiation. You are naturally radioactive yourself. And wherever we are, there is a degree of radiation around us. It comes from rocks, things like that. We're being exposed to radiation, also this cosmic rays coming from the sky. And if you, say, I don't know, flew about 10 hours a week for a whole year, the extra radiation you get exposed to is about the same as you get from moving from London to Cornwall. Because in Cornwall, there's a lot more granite, there's a lot more natural radiation. It's nearly twice as high, the natural level in Cornwall. And it's about that same level of increase if you flew about 10 hours a week every week through the year. So it's not that bad.
One of the interesting points that you talk about in the section of the book that's about at the airport is the idea that for superstitious reasons there's never a gate 13.
Well, I can't guarantee there isn't. I mean, there probably is some airport around the world where there is a gate 13, but it's relatively uncommon. And certainly in Western airports, I don't know if it's also true, because the sort of number associations, say, in China tend to be rather different from our own. But 13, you know, everybody knows, considered unlucky. And because of that, there isn't usually one. I think the particularly nice version of that is at Terminal 4 in Heathrow, where when they built it, they very consciously put gate 12 at one end and gate 14 at the other end. You know, it's a long, thin building, so that you can't actually see that gate 13's missing. So you don't think, ooh, well, if 13's missing, then 14 must really be 13. So that's unlucky. So I thought that was quite a nice gesture.
That'd be never-ending, wouldn't it? Oh, well, we better get rid of gate 14 now.
That's right, but there is absolutely no evidence of any problems with gate 13s any more than any other gate.
So let's talk a little bit then about we've gone through the security and the scanners, and luckily we've not had to go through gate 13 to get on our plane, and we're on the plane. Let's perhaps talk a little bit about how the plane actually gets into the air. And one of the things you talk about is the interesting properties of jet fuel. So talk us through what's different to jet fuel to the fuel that we would put in a car, for instance.
Well, it isn't, I mean, hugely different. In a sense, that this property that I'm talking about there is also true of petrol. And it's the reason why it is so difficult, frankly, to move away from fossil fuels, is it just packs in a huge amount of energy. I think it's a really good comparison that if you think of replacing either petrol or jet fuel with batteries, and you took the most efficient batteries we've got at the moment, it would take about 100 times more weight in batteries. So the amount of energy you get out of 10 kilograms of fuel, say, you'd need a ton of batteries to give you the same amount of energy. So if you think of the amount of fuel you need on a plane, it would be totally impractical to carry that number of batteries.
So we're basically never going to see electric planes.
I think it's very unlikely. I mean, it's possible we could get away from aviation fuel by moving to something like hydrogen, but even there you've got a problem. It's not the weight in that case, because weight's obviously the problem of the batteries. The problem with hydrogen is actually volume, that it is actually lighter than jet fuel, but you can't compress it enough to get it down to a small enough volume. And as a compressed gas, which is the obvious way of carrying it, it's about six times as much volume. And if you think of how much volume the fuel takes up, which basically typically fills all the wings, you'd be filling the entire plane with hydrogen to be able to get away with it. I mean, I think a good picture to imagine just how much the fuel crams in the energy is that aviation fuel or petrol is about 15 times as much energy per unit weight as TNT. You know, the explosive TNT. You think of that, you know, immense amount of energy. Mm-hmm. But actually, for the same weight of petrol or gasoline or kerosene to TNT, it's 15 times as much energy packed in, which is why, incidentally, the planes were so effective on September 11th, because it was the energy from the fuel that caused all the damage.
Well, I was going to say, so what's the volatility of it like? I mean, obviously we know that, you know, so that happened and the planes obviously exploded, but, in, you know, clearly it must be deemed safe to use. I mean, if you talk about hydrogen and I immediately think of, like, you know, the Hindenburg or something and think, oh, that's not very...
Yeah.
Sorry, good, but so what's the sort of volatility of aircraft fuel like?
Well, aircraft fuel is not, it's not huge, it's kerosene, basically. It's the stuff that people sometimes use in stoves. So, you know, it's not that different from petrol in terms of its volatility. It's a little bit lighter, but basically it's similar sort of stuff. So it's something that's manageable if it is sensibly controlled. I mean, hydrogen actually isn't that bad. You know that there are some hydrogen cars out there. Mm-hmm. Some people are quite enthusiastic about hydrogen cars. As long as it's controlled properly. I mean, the trouble with the Hindenburg is obviously you've got a great big envelope full of this stuff. You'd got motors next to it. It was just asking for things to go wrong. Whereas obviously in a modern sense, it's held in a tank. It's kept away from things that could cause a spark.
Let's talk about the... We've moved the plane now onto, taxied the plane onto the runway, and you talk about the sort of intricacies of the configuration of the runways and the way that they're numbered. And this is absolutely fascinating. So tell us about why the runways have, why they're in certain directions and why they have numbering.
I mean, the directions is fairly straightforward. It's basically you want to take off into the wind because essentially you don't have to go as fast to get in as much lift, because if you're going into the wind, you've got the air moving over the wings already. So you only need to go, say, you know, so that's a particular speed plus the speed of the wind. And so ideally, it would be perfect if you could choose whichever direction you liked. If you had, you know, a huge circular area and you took off in any direction, that would be wonderful. It's not practical. So what you do is you have it, the main runway is facing in the prevailing wind direction. And so at Heathrow, there used to be, for instance, two different runway directions. They've actually shut the cross runway because it was too short for modern aircraft. So they actually only have two parallel runways going the same way now. But you can go from both ends. And if you look at them from above, you can see this on Google Earth or whatever, you'll actually see that they have numbers painted on the end that basically show the compass direction. So if you imagine sort of 0 to 360 degrees, mm-hmm. it's really just the first two numbers. So, you know, if it says, I don't know, 2-3, it's 230 degrees sort of round from north, if you imagine going around in a full circle. And that's just giving you the direction of the runway.
There's a great story in the book about a plane landing at Northolt rather than Heathrow. Just tell us that why that was an issue.
Yeah, I mean, this is in the old days when most of the direction finding was by eye. So you get to roughly the right area with a radio beacon, and then you'd be looking out, looking for landmarks, and use those to get you on your final approach. And the landmark they typically used at Heathrow, there's a big blue gas holder. You see it if you're on the train going from Paddington. It's on the right as you go down from Paddington. And they basically used that to line up with the runway. And the only problem was there is a very similar big blue gas holder in the same position with respect to the runway at Northolt Aerodrome. And I think this was in the late 60s, possibly early 70s, around then. An American 707 actually mistook Northolt for Heathrow, landed at Northolt, and then there was a real problem because a plane can actually land in a shorter runway than it can take off in. It needs more runway to take off, and it couldn't actually take off. They had to literally strip everything out of the plane, all the seats out, everything out to get it off. And local legend has it there are actually tire marks on the roof of a building at the end of the runway. I'm not sure if that's true, but it's a nice story. But now those, if you look at those gas holders, they actually have letters painted on them. The Heathrow one says LH, London Heathrow, just so the people didn't pick the wrong gas holder. But of course now they would be using GPS and all sorts of things. They're not just reliant on what they can see.
You're listening to Little Atoms tonight with me, Neil Denny, and I'm talking to Brian Clegg about his book In Flight Science. So, Brian, everybody listening at home will know, have an idea about how planes actually are able to fly. We all know this story of the different speeds that the air flows across the wing because of the shape of the wing. But it turns out that's not strictly true.
Well, yes, it causes some controversy, this. In fact, some friends of mine run a small airport, and all the people who've got microlights and things there have been having furious arguments since I produced this book, because they tend to stick to this idea about different speeds of air moving over the wing. But all the evidence is, if you look at, for instance, NASA's website, and they ought to know what they're talking about, that actually that is just wrong. And in a sense, it's a simpler explanation. We're back to Newton's laws that most people remember from school, particularly specifically Newton's third law. Which is something you definitely experienced on the plane, because basically what's happening with the plane is a jet engine is shoving out lots of stuff out the back, and because you're pushing the stuff out the back, that stuff pushes the plane forward, and that's how you get forward motion. And air, as you say, starts moving over the wing, and the way the wings are shaped, the air actually moves downwards. Basically you've got exactly the same thing happening. Because the air's being pushed downwards, it pushes the wing upwards. And it's actually that sort of Newton's third law motion that's mostly responsible for the lift. I mean, there are other things happening. There are things about pressure happening, but that is the main component.
So I want to talk a little bit about once we're actually in the air, how we basically are able to stay alive up there, because the planes are, you know, cruising at 30,000-40,000 feet or something. Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about how the cabins are pressurised. And I've read an interesting fact in the book, which is that the air pressure on a plane is generally the same as it is in a high-altitude city like Mexico City, for instance, you use. So why is that?
It's a matter of compromise. Basically, the higher the pressure in the plane, the thicker the walls have to be in order to hold it in, the thicker the glass has to be, all that kind of stuff, which makes the plane heavier. But on the other hand, you want to fly high, because if you're flying high, you're basically above most of the weather. That's the main reason. You've also got a bit less air resistance, so you use less fuel. So there's two things happening: less fuel, but also a lot less bumpy, which obviously is quite attractive. So because of that, they want to go high, but they can't really pressurise it to sea level, because it would just require too much weight in the plane. And it's just a sensible compromise. It's the sort of level that people are reasonably comfortable at. You know, if you went up to 10,000-12,000 feet, people are starting to feel it's a bit of a struggle. But around the 8,000 feet mark, something like that, it's not too bad. It's acceptable, but it means you don't have to reinforce the plane so much.
But then it's only acceptable if we don't want to have a cup of tea with our in-flight meal. Why can't we make a decent cup of tea on it?
Yeah, it's just a bit sad. I mean, I have to confess, I'm a coffee drinker, so I'm not fussed. But I know a lot of people are really fussy about how their tea's made. People always tell me, if I'm making tea for them, you know, you must use boiling water. It has to be boiling. It's no point having it sort of bit off the boil. And boiling water, we all know, at sea level, boils at 100 degrees. But basically, the higher up you go, the lower the temperature it boils at. And at sort of cabin pressure, it'll boil at about 90 degrees C. And you won't get it past that unless you've got a pressure cooker, which they don't have, I don't think. So basically, you're getting your tea made at that sort of temperature. If they actually went out, sat on the wing and made it, which incidentally I wouldn't recommend, it'd actually boil about 53 degrees. So, you know, it'd hardly be hot enough to get your tea bag operating. But it doesn't help, obviously, having it out of plastic cups and all that kind of stuff as well. But the fact is, you're never going to get a perfect cup up there.
You mentioned the idea of it'd be an ideal to fly at that sort of height, because of the, you know, there's less air and there'll be less turbulence. Turbulence is something that people who have been on planes would have experienced. So let's talk about why it is. What is turbulence?
Turbulence is just the plane being influenced by moving air. I mean, just, you know, because we can't see the air and we tend to think of it as being relatively insubstantial. But you do get quite a lot of air movement. It's usually due to differences in temperature. You find as you go up, for instance, that you sometimes get an inversion in temperature, where the temperature has been going down and down and then, and suddenly it shoots up. And at that layer between the sort of lower and higher, you'll find air rushing from one place to another, and that will take the plane with it. Basically, if you hit that, that's your sort of clear air turbulence, and it gives you a sudden jolt. The other obvious thing is storms. I mean, some of the big storm clouds, the big cumulonimbus clouds, can go up you know, up to twice the height that planes fly at. They're absolutely enormous. And they're the pilots really have to go around them. You know, they have radar that point out specifically where these things are to watch out for them because it can't be avoided. But I think the thing to bear in mind with turbulence, it can be a bit scary, but the fact is no modern airliner, there have been one or two old ones, but no modern airliner has been brought down by turbulence. They can cope with it. You know, they're built to cope with it.
You just brought up clouds, so let's move on to talk. You talk a little bit about clouds in the book, and there's another really interesting fact, which again is something that people just don't really think about. But you talk about why clouds, clearly being, you know, water is heavier than air, so why don't clouds fall out of the sky?
Yeah, I mean, a cloud isn't gas. I mean, that's the first thing to think. Some people sometimes think it's water vapor, it's gas, and it isn't. You can't see water vapor. It's totally transparent. It's transparent gas. What a cloud is lots of little droplets of water. And as you say, you put a drop of water, let one go, it will fall. And actually, clouds do fall. I think that was I didn't realise this till I researched the book. But because the drops are so incredibly tiny, they're getting battered by the air molecules all the time, and that slows them down a lot. So basically, if you had a cloud that was just sitting there and waited, it will fall about 1 metre in a year. So they do fall, but really, really slowly, which I think is really quite a nice picture.
And of course, they're dissipate. You're not going to get a cloud hanging around for a year anyway. So
that's never actually
going to happen. There's also the a story which is really sweet in the book about how we get the saying "cloud nine." So let's tell us what that is.
Yeah, the sort of clouds are put into different categories, and broadly there were nine of these categories, and the highest cloud type was cloud nine. I mean, they have names as well, but they were numbered, these categories, and that's just where the expression came from. Being on cloud nine is you were on top of the highest, you're as high as you could get, you're as high as a kite, sort of thing. But they decided after a while that there really should be 10 categories and not nine. And so they went from 1 to 10 instead of from 1 to 9. And I think it's really quite romantic that after a while, the people who decided this kind of thing thought, well, you know, this is a bit unfair. So they actually shifted the scale. And so instead of going 1 to 10, it went 0 to 9. So the cloud 9 again was the highest cloud. I thought it was quite sweet, really.
I'm going to spend the remainder of the show just basically throwing at you some questions that come up in the book that are, you know, questions that seem people often ask. You recognise the things that I'm talking about when I ask them. So let's talk about what would happen if I smashed the window on a plane.
Well, I'd say, first of all, it is very, very difficult. You know, when you go on a plane, you sort of poke the window, it seems a bit flimsy. That's just because there is just a plastic inner. That thing isn't the window. It's just something to stop you scratching the window. The window itself is actually very, very strong, rigid, special little glass that's outside that plastic. And it is would be very difficult to break. Obviously, it is possible. You could shoot it through it with a gun if you happen to have one about your person, which I hope you won't. But if you did do that, the sort of stuff you see in the movies is frankly a bit exaggerated. You know, the chances are, even if the whole window went out, you're not going to see lots of people being sucked out of the window. There would be a lot of air going that way. Small things would fly out of the window, certainly. But it's pretty likely that you would be able to stop yourself going. You know, it is exaggerated. But, of course, you then drop down to the air pressure at 35,000, 40,000 feet, which isn't breathable. So you need to get those masks. And incidentally, I hope it never happens, but if that ever does happen, a really useful tip is if you're travelling, say, with children, your natural inclination might be to get them on them. Don't. Put yours on first, because you don't have that long. You only have about 10 seconds or so before you lose consciousness. So it's a good idea. Get yours on, then you can help your children or people around you. So it feels a bit selfish, but that's the thing to do. But it's not going to happen.
In a similar vein, in the movie, there's often a scene on the plane where somebody will attempt to open one of the doors,
yeah,
but it turns out this isn't really possible either.
Yeah, I really wouldn't recommend trying, because although it isn't possible, you know, if the cabin crew find you trying to open the door, they will probably assume the worst and you'll end up in handcuffs and being escorted off the plane. But the fact is, it is physically impossible. What certainly, once you're up a little bit, if you ever watch an aircraft door opening, they open in a really weird way, because they actually go into the plane and then swing out to the outside. And the reason they go into the plane is basically that the pressure of the air in the inside, because you've got a higher pressure inside the plane than outside, is pushing that door into place. And you're literally talking about sort of trying to move a ton or that sort of amount with your bare hands type of thing. If you're trying to open it against that pressure, it just isn't going to happen.
And again, continuing on a similar vein, everybody believes this idea that it's possible to get sucked down the toilet in a plane. Is this really true?
I'm glad to say no. I mean, I don't. Hopefully, nobody thinks you'd actually get sucked down it, because it would be a fairly small hole, but certainly sucked onto it. That there is an urban legend around that somebody got stuck on a plane for a couple of hours until they finally got rescued by an engineer when they landed. This is true. Turned out, as far as I'm aware, to have been basically a story. It was a story that was made up for a training exercise, but somehow escaped. The fact is A, it's incredibly difficult because the button push for the vacuum toilet is usually behind the seat, so somehow you'd have to get the seat down while sitting on it to get to the button. But also the chances of actually making a good enough seal on something like that to actually get that vacuum sticking you on is pretty low. But don't try it if it was still possible, because you could actually damage yourself. You know, you would be putting a lot of pressures on your innards, and it's not a good move.
Okay, to finish off then... last year, everyone will be familiar with, I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it, but the Icelandic volcano.
Yes, please don't ask me to pronounce it.
so much disruption to air travel. But let's talk a little bit about why that was. What was that actually about?
Yeah, I mean, some people have thought, ooh, you know, was there any need for this? And I personally think there definitely was. You know, there have been instances in the past. I guess the most famous one was a British Airways jet where all four engine shut down near a volcano in the Far East, and that dropped, I think it was getting on for 20,000 feet before they could restart the engines. And that was the same problem that they were worried about with this one, which is basically it's throwing out lots of tiny shards of glass, very tiny shards, which when they get in the hot engine, which is extremely hot, melt, but then they hit the blades back of the engine. By that time, they've cooled down a bit and they solidify. And the trouble is that basically tends to stop the engines. So it really was a very sensible precaution. It's a perfectly natural thing. It is going to happen occasionally. We've just been lucky, frankly, that we haven't had more of it up till now.
And, I mean, how do they go about sort of checking that it's, you know, what's the sort of process for checking that the air is safe again? Because that, you know, that volcano was going for ages, and you know, and the cloud obviously could stay around for a long time, and it could be that a bigger eruption would have a cloud that stayed around for months. I mean, how do they actually go about testing to see that it's okay?
Well, I mean, basically a matter of monitoring the levels of these contaminants in the air, and obviously using the meteorological models to predict the way things are going and that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, if we had something like you know, the Krakatoa eruption from the 18 whatevers happening now, I think the chances are that aviation will be shut down across the world, probably for a whole year or something like that, which would be quite stunning if you think
that would
the impact
be incredible,
would
wouldn't it? Yeah, yeah, it's hard to imagine what a world would be like, how much that would change, economically and everything. We're out of time, Brian. It's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thanks for coming in and talking to Little Atoms today.
Great, thanks. I've really enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Little Atoms. You can find details of upcoming guests at our website, littleatoms.com. The Little Atoms podcast is available on iTunes. Thanks for listening.